It's Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yesterday afternoon, the world learned that a man regarded as one of the greatest leaders in modern history had passed away. Nelson Mandela was known for his relentless commitment to peace and reconciliation, and he showed grace as he helped transform an apartheid nation of minority white rule into a modern democracy, an accomplishment that few thought would be the peaceful transition it was. Nelson Mandela was 95.
As South Africa and the world reflect on the loss of a man who was seen as a moral compass, questions arise over the future of South African politics and Mandela's effect on other African leaders. Yesterday in Central Time, we discussed Mandela's legacy and got your reactions to the news of his passing. Today, we'd like to take a step back and take a look at one of the defining periods of his life.
In 1964, Nelson Mandela was found guilty of sabotage, a crime punishable by death. And instead of the death penalty, he was sent to Robben Island for life imprisonment. He stayed in prison for 27 years. While many may have lost hope, Mandela stayed devoted to his cause. And after he was released in 1982, he became South Africa's first post-apartheid president. Well, here to discuss Mandela's sentence on Robben Island is Ken Brown. He's the professor of law at University of North Carolina Law School and the author of Saving Nelson Mandela. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about the events leading up to Mandela's trial for sabotage?
Well, he had been arrested in 1962. He had gone underground. He had been up through Africa talking to other African leaders and, frankly, getting some military training. He came back to South Africa and was working undercover with his group, Umgunte Wizizwe, which was the spear of the nation, the armed wing of the ANC and the South African Communist Party. He had gone into hiding, and somehow he was betrayed and arrested on the road just outside of Durban.
And so he was arrested in 1962 for something else.
He was arrested in 62. He was put on trial. He was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment at that point for leaving the country without a passport and for inciting an illegal strike. He was sent to Robben Island. While he was on Robben Island, there was a raid at the headquarters of Umgunte Wizizwe, which was a farmhouse just outside of Johannesburg, in which a number of the leaders were arrested and some 200 documents were found. Some of those documents were authored by Mandela. Some were in his handwriting with plans for sabotage and plans for recruiting militants to be trained abroad. The leadership was charged. Mandela was brought back to Johannesburg, back to eventually to Pretoria to be tried with the others on charges of sabotage, which carried the death penalty.
So, but he didn't get the death penalty. Was
there
a reason?
He did not get the death penalty.
So what's the deal with that?
That was a remarkable turn of events. When he was charged, when the trial began in October of 1963, I think the conventional wisdom, both in South Africa and abroad, that he would be executed along with the other principal leaders. During the course of the trial, a number of things happened. There were some brilliant legal advocacy by his defense team, led by the outstanding Afrikaner lawyer, Bram Fischer, and others. There was some bad advocacy on the part of the prosecution, which irritated the judge. I think that the government may have lost interest in executing him. There were some subtle pressures put on the government at that point. The Americans and the British were not particularly upfront in defending Mandela, but they let it be known that while they probably had no objection to his imprisonment, they didn't want him executed. So there were a number of factors that combined to the sentence of life for he and most of the others. There were two defendants that were acquitted.
And so basically, South Africa was kind of thinking about its position in the world then a little bit.
Well, it's quite possible that there were no statement on the part of the government from which you could find that out, but I've certainly read the correspondence from the American Embassy and from the British Foreign Office, and I think that they felt that South Africa was at least somewhat concerned about their place in the world. They at least cared what the British and the Americans thought about them.
So could you tell us about Robben Island, where he was sent?
Well, Robben Island was a general prison when he was first sent there. That is, there were both political prisoners and there were people charged with actual crimes. That was for the first few years. I think the government assumed that the criminals would keep the political prisoners under control. Actually, just the opposite happened. The political prisoners recruited the criminals, and they eventually moved the other people out, and it would simply became a prison for political prisoners. But it was a very harsh place. There was harsh labor in a rock quarry just outside the prison. The prisoners were brought there every day. During the early years, there was not much ability to for the prisoners to even to talk to one another except while they were working.
So in an environment like that, how did Nelson Mandela stay connected and engaged?
Well,
in politics?
There was some contact, and the prisoners managed to communicate with each other. There were limited visits from the outside world, but there were some visits. Some of the lawyers were able to come in. Some family members were able to come in. But it was pretty minimal, at least for the first, I'd estimate, 10 years. After that, by the mid-70s, things loosened up a little bit. They were permitted at least to get books. They were not often permitted to get current newspapers, but they could get books, they could study, they could take degrees, and there were lots of interaction at that point. And Robben Island became pretty much like a mini university for very bright political prisoners, and much of the theory of what the new South Africa would be like was formed by the people who were there. It became Robben Island University, as some of the people who were there have referred to it. A friend of mine was on the island for 10 years from the time he was in he was 15. Till 25, and did all of his education there.
So that whole experience on Robben Island has had an impact on South Africa moving forward because of what people learned there.
I think that's right. I think even now politically in South Africa there are some distinction made between the group of people who got their education at Robben Island and the group who were in exile. It's just a somewhat different way of looking at it, different factions of the ANC.
So Nelson Mandela was in prison for 27 years. What was it like when he was released from prison in South Africa?
Well, it was a remarkable moment. He actually, the last couple of years of his imprisonment were very different, certainly from the early years. He was in a private house on the outskirts of a prison. He was still confined, but he had frequent visitors. He had visitors from the government. He had visitors from the ANC. He had visitors from his lawyers, and he had begun at that point to exert leadership. So his involvement began in a very serious way a couple of years before. His actual release was a symbolic moment. I think for those of us who were involved at that time, and I was a visitor, but I was I was there frequently, and that was the moment at which we thought, my God, this is going to happen. This is going to change. And I think there was a general feeling in South Africa, at least among the anti-apartheid people, that finally things were going to get better. We didn't know how long, we didn't know how violent, we didn't know exactly what nature it would take. And some of the reason, a good deal of the reason why it happened and happened in a less violent than everyone thought way was because of Mandela's leadership.
Well, Ken Brown, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Ken Brown's a professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School and the author of Saving Nelson Mandela. Thanks for joining us.
We'll be checking the headlines next with Kristen Durst, and then we'll be back with Food Friday. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Mike Arnold. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Gene Purcell. It's Food Friday, and today we're having a spirited discussion about, well, spirits.
Well, as the temperatures have dropped to the single digits, it's mighty cold out there around the state. The days of mojitos and mint juleps, I almost called them mint juleps, on the porch are far behind us. Maybe not for me, it sounds like. But the change in weather does bring its own collection of seasonal drinks.
So, for example, do eggnog and hot buttered rum ring a bell to you? Well, today we're joined by Troy Patterson, and we're going to take a look at some wintry punches and cocktails. Troy is Slate's writer-at-large and gentleman scholar columnist. Troy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first I have to sort of set the stage for you. Right before I spoke with you, I took a look at some of the weather conditions around Wisconsin, and I think we may be one of the hot spots here in Madison. It's 9 above right now. We have a small town in Wisconsin called Winter, where it is 2 degrees below zero as we speak. So it is time for warm drinks. And I'm wondering, besides, you know, just the mere fact that they're warm, what are some of the elements that make up a really great winter drink or winter cocktail?
Well, I think the most important thing is that the mug itself needs to be warm. You've got to pre-warm the mug by pouring some like boiling water into that while you start mixing things up, because otherwise the temperature of the drink itself will drop instantly. It'll have a less pleasant experience.
You know, it's those details that always trip me up. Now I'm understanding my lack of popularity around this time of the year. So warm mug. Key.
That's
okay.
A good first start.
So yeah. We got the warm mug. What do we do with it?
Well, I mean, that's up to you. I mean, the first thing is I'm a big fan of, I mean, I'm always in favor of drinking responsibly. I think that is especially important in the winter. For one thing, it's that, you know, alcohol lowers your core body temperature, and it gets to you more quickly, a hot drink does, than a cold drink, because your system doesn't have to warm it up to body temperature in order to
get
it into your bloodstream. Yeah, so that's
a thing
to be aware of. Yeah.
That actually explains.
I used to have people tell me that the warm drinks burned the alcohol off, so you didn't have to worry about it as much. So it's the opposite.
It's the opposite.
Wow. That's good to know.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you guys are, I'm in New York. You guys are in Wisconsin, which is one of the homes to what I think is the great eggnog tradition of the Tom and Jerry, which is, you know, the brandy and dark rum and egg white. It's the most palatable way to enjoy an eggnog, I think.
What are some other regional favorites? You mentioned the Tom and Jerry here in the Midwest, but as we go around the country, are there other favorites, the East Coast, the West Coast, or, you know, the mountains that we might look at and say there's a drink that defines that area?
Oh, that's a good question, a tough one. I'm tempted to sort of like vamp while I rack my brains to figure something out. I don't know if I have a great direct answer to that question, but I would be interested in like reading a survey of what the ski resort bartenders have to say about.
So you mentioned the Tom and Jerry, which I guess is sort of like an eggnog. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Are there hot drinks that have like milk based products in them, and then hot drinks that have like citrus in them, more like a punch? Are there different themes in hot drinks?
Oh, definitely. I mean, my favorite sort of hot drink that's dairy-based is, like a hot brandy Alexander. You know, Brandy Alexander being brandy and creme de cacao and milk. And I think when that's made warm with some steamed milk, it's like the wonderful, like, exact opposite of coffee. It's sort of like at the end of the night, sort of like a nice soothing, sort of like steamed milk and brandy and creme de cacao will sort of a great nightcap to send you on your way. You know, I can't think of any sort of citrus-based hot drinks, but, you know, in making a hot toddy with whatever sort of base liquor you like, I think that a big squeeze of usually lemon and sometimes lime, maybe if it's a rum-based drink, will go a long way towards creating something that is pleasing and provides at least the illusion of giving you good health.
So are warm drinks kind of old-fashioned? Because, I mean, I think of, like, you know, the movie It's a Wonderful Life, you know, the Frank Capra movie where the guy comes into the bar and he orders the hot drink and they throw him out because they think there's something wrong with him. Is that something that – are there some people who, like, if you go into a bar, is it hard to get a hot drink?
I don't know. I mean, I sort of know a few kind of – even dirty little dive bars that always keep like an electric kettle around just in case somebody wants a toddy. But on the other hand, I know some like very sophisticated bartenders who have in off the top of their head, they have these libraries of 2,000 or 3,000 cold drinks who are sort of like, scared of, hostile to, ignorant of, unfamiliar with hot drinks. So it's kind of a specialist, area, I suppose.
Let me ask you this. Earlier, you talked a little bit about the idea of responsible drinking. Are there some good non-alcoholic versions of these drinks for folks who might want to partake at the party but don't necessarily want to drink alcohol?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I mean, hot cocoa is hot cocoa. I suppose that you can operate along sort of like general principles. But well, here's one thing that I'll say is that it's fun to just like order a cup of tea in like a good cocktail bar because you can find out quickly how well you can like accentuate your tea by just playing with some syrups or grating some fresh nutmeg on top or just using a little bit of some like allspice liqueur to drink up. To spice up something when you're not interested in a serious drinking session.
So as I understand it, you're a fan of punches around the holiday season. What kind of suggestions do you have for us?
Well, there's a classic drink called Philadelphia Fish House Punch that's sort of sweet and fruity. It's and it hails from Pennsylvania, the men's club in the mid-1700s.
So what's in a fish house punch?
Yeah, it just doesn't sound very
tasty.
Unattractive,
to me, so.
Yeah.
There's brandy, there's rum, there's a little bit of peach liqueur, there's lemon juice, there's sugar. I believe, according to the history of the men's club that originated it, it was invented for a Christmas party. It was the first occasion that women were allowed inside of the clubhouse, and they were looking for a concoction that would be pleasing to the ladies' palates while also making them livelier than is their usual wont.
Huh. Well, interesting. So that sounds interesting. And if you were having a party for the holidays, what would you serve people?
Well, punches are always fun because people gather around them. It's festive. There's an atmosphere of sharing. I like a nice mulled wine is good because you know how parties and houses are. Everyone always ends up in the kitchen anyway, so as long as they're in there, why not put a bit of wine in a big stock pot with some spices, maybe a little bit of brandy to give it a kick.
It also is a nice smell in the house too. It sort of makes the house smell festive too.
Doesn't it smell like Christmas? It's very sort of.
Oh, my goodness.
And it sounds as though we've lost Troy Patterson. He is Slate's writer at large.
Are you still there? Wait. I can kind of hear you.
I think he's gone.
Looks like we lost your... Well, you know, the fish house punch thing, I believe we actually have that written up somewhere. So we can share that with you. If you're interested in getting it, you can go to our Facebook page, the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll have Troy Patterson's Fish House Punch recipe on there. Troy Patterson, of course, is Slate's writer at large and gentleman scholar columnist, and we were talking to him on Central Time.
That's right. And again, check it out on our Facebook page, and we've got other recipes that you can share there as well.
Yes. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll hear from a group of singers in Wisconsin who honor the ancient tradition of singing at the bedsides of people who are sick and struggling.
We'll also take a look back at 2013 through the lens of the year's scientific discoveries.
And our Wisconsin Life segment features the life of Otis Redding, the legendary musician who died in a plane crash in Madison.
That's coming up on Monday on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear why some Vietnam veterans are returning to Vietnam. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Mike Arnold filling in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about why the unemployment rate in the United States has fallen to its lowest level in 5 years.
First, though, it's been almost 40 years since the end of the Vietnam War. And while time has healed some wounds on both sides, there are still a lot of unanswered questions and unresolved issues.
And according to our next guest, veterans of the war are doing something about it. Some vets are living there and attempting to foster reconciliation between the two countries, while other former U.S. soldiers are traveling there to find closure.
Joining us now to talk about this is Nissa Ree. She is a writer and a journalist. Her piece, Why U.S. Veterans Are Returning to Vietnam, was the cover story in the Christian Science Monitor. Nissa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we appreciate having you along with us. I want to start out by talking about this idea of going back. And soldiers throughout history, I think, have been going back. And certainly we saw that, you know, soldiers from World War II going back to Normandy Beach and so forth. But in your piece, you point out that going back to Vietnam is different.
Yes, it's different for two main reasons. You know, one, in the case of Vietnam War, we lost. So soldiers who came back had to live with that stigma, and there was a very unpopular sentiment around the war, as opposed to World War II, where the veterans were seen mostly as heroes. And another reason is that until the mid-1990s, it was very difficult for Americans to go to Vietnam and return to those battlefields. The U.S. had sanctions, and it wasn't until 1995, 20 years after the fall of Saigon, that relations between the two countries were normalized.
But there were vets who were trying to get back to Vietnam before that, wasn't there? And as I understand it, it was tough to get in, and it was tough to stay there.
That's right. It was really tough to get in, and the vets who did go back in those early years were warned by the State Department and others, you know, they shouldn't go back, that it's dangerous there, that there is no U.S. embassy or support there. But they really wanted to go back, and, you know, for a number of reasons. You know, the MIA soldier issue was still big in people's minds. There was the question of Vietnamese-American children fathered by U.S. troops. And there was, just a lot of open wounds that people were looking for closure there and reconciliation.
So what made this a topic that you decided was worthy of further study and ultimately a book?
Well, I think it's a really unique and inspirational story. You know, we often hear about wars when they're going on, and we might hear about some of the legacies of a war, even of the landmine victims, or in the case of Vietnam, Agent Orange victims. But we don't often hear about former enemies, the people who are actually shooting each other, coming together like this and addressing the consequences of war like they're doing in Vietnam.
And, you know, it seems to me that after the Vietnam War ended, that for a long time, the American media didn't necessarily even want to talk about it very much. There were other things to cover, other stories.
That's right. So it is a story that's really slipped out of the consciousness. And even in our history classes today, Vietnam War is not something that's covered in a lot of high schools or grade schools. So you have a new generation coming up, my generation, that did not grow up during the war and who really know very little about the war. And I think that's really troubling. You know, the Gallup did a poll earlier this year, and they found that the only population of Americans who think that the U.S. was justified in going to war in Vietnam are people under 30, so the younger people who know very little about the war.
And so where do you start when you're working on a book like this? The whole premise is, you know, veterans who have gone back for one reason or another, but as we've already discussed, there are a lot of veterans with a lot of different reasons for going back. They may be living there. They may be just visiting. How do you start trying to sort all of this out?
Well, for me, it was a matter of getting to know some of the American veterans who are working in Vietnam, and they often know other people. You know, there's in an expat community anywhere, there's a lot of connections usually. But among Vietnam American veterans living in Vietnam, they're very tight community. They often get together for different activities, for Thanksgiving, or to work on projects together. So they have a strong network that I was able to tap into and get to know the men living and working there.
Yeah, and one of the ex-soldiers that you talked with and featured in your article is a person named Greg Clevin. He's been living in Ho Chi Minh City, I think, since about the early 1990s, making him the very first American to live in Ho Chi Minh City after the war. So maybe let's focus on him for a few minutes. Why did he make the decision to go back to Vietnam and stay?
Well, he was, like a lot of the men who returned, he was curious about what was going on there. So that was one of the main reasons he went back for the first time as a tourist. He was wondering what happened to Vietnam and Vietnamese people after he left, because, as you mentioned, there wasn't much media coverage after Saigon fell in 1975. And once he was there, he really saw he could do some good there. He felt like he had some, you know, things that he regretted doing as a soldier, and now was a chance for him to be a teacher instead and help people instead of killing them.
And let's talk about his life in Ho Chi Minh City now, because in the article that you wrote in the Christian Science Monitor, that cover story, it's pointed out that if you're returning to Ho Chi Minh City now and you were there, you know, in the 60s or 70s, you're not going to really recognize it.
Yes, it's a very different city. And, you know, in some ways it's very westernized, has a lot of tall buildings, and you know, all the international businesses are headquartered in Ho Chi Minh City. So there's not a lot of remnants of the war there. I mean, there are museums, and you can, just a little outside of Saigon, you can visit the old Cu Chi tunnels where the North Vietnamese troops would hide and, you know, ambush people during the war. So there's tourist attractions, but it's really a completely transformed city today.
And how is it, you know, how does it feel for veterans and, I guess, tourists who return to Ho Chi Minh City these days, knowing that it was the site of so much, you know, so many terrible things that happened, and, you know, going there and seeing it sort of, I don't want to say covered up, but you know, there are beaches now, there are tourist destinations, and yet underneath it all is, you know, the specter of all those things that happened 40 or 50 years ago. How does that resonate with the veterans who are there? What are they trying to accomplish when they go back, when they live there? And, how are they trying to put all these pieces together?
Well, it is, you know, like some veteran told me that it's like visiting your old grade school. So some things look a lot smaller than they used to. Some things look a lot different than you remember. So in some ways, you know, veterans who go back and they go back to a place they fought in a battlefield, for example, will find that there's hardly anything there left. They won't be finding lots of bullet shells even. It might be a farm. It might be a village now. And so that will be a shock to some people and a disappointment. But in other ways, it's a relief for a lot of veterans to know that, you know, the war did not destroy the country. This Vietnam has gone on, it has prospered, and there are still, you know, these remnants of war and consequences of war. But, you know, by and large, Vietnam has moved on and is, you know, a fully modernized country now.
And as I understand it, it seems as though the traffic in terms of veterans returning to Vietnam is picking up these days, as many of them are retiring, they've got more free time and so forth. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, the number of tourists going back from the U.S. to Vietnam seems to be picking up. And, you know, of course, that's great for the Vietnamese tourism industry. But it seems to be, from talking to tourist agencies, that, you know, American veterans are older now. Many of them are in 60s or 70s. They're retired. They have more time to travel and possibly more money now that their children are not around. So they're able to go back to Vietnam and experience it and, you know, revisit the places they served.
And at the same time, when they go back, at some point they must run into a person who may have been a soldier that they fought against at some point.
Yes, a lot of the veterans I've talked to have told me about that. Usually on the first day even, someone comes up to them and asks them if they were a veteran or if they served there before. And a lot of them are nervous what will happen next. But most people are, you know, extremely welcoming. And, you know, what I found is that a lot of Vietnamese respect American veterans more than, say, me or any other American citizen, because they serve their country and they really respect that patriotic duty they did.
Now, how open were veterans to talking to you about this? I mean, it seems like you're dredging up some pretty emotional subjects, some pretty difficult times for them. Are these topics that, as a rule, you had easy access to, or did it take some digging? Did it take some prodding to get the stories out?
Well, I think the American veterans who are living in Vietnam today have done a lot of soul searching, and most of them are pretty open about talking about the experience they went through, you know, leaving Vietnam and living with their memories in the U.S. and then returning to Vietnam. Now, but most veterans will never go back to Vietnam. You know, a lot of veterans never want to talk about their experience during the war. So, you know, they are a bit of an exception in that way. But I found that the Vietnam vets in Vietnam were pretty open with me about what they had gone through.
We're talking with Nissa Rhee about veterans, the idea of Vietnam veterans returning to Vietnam, and we'd like to hear from you, too. Are you a veteran of any war or a Vietnam veteran? And is Vietnam a place that you would like to go back to, see where you were, see what it's like now? 40 years down the road, what do you think needs to be done to foster reconciliation between these two countries? Give us a call. We have a toll-free number for you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email. That address is talk@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation right after the break. But first, here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon with Kristen Durst of the WPR News Department. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're continuing our conversation now with Nissa Rhee about Vietnam veterans returning to Vietnam. She's got a piece in the Christian Science Monitor on this, and she's working on a book on it as well. If you'd like to join in the discussion, you can do that at 800-642-1234. If you're a Vietnam vet, have you ever considered the idea of going back? 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones right now, and Harry is with us from Rhinelander. Hi.
Hello. I spent two tours in Vietnam, 1967, 1968, 1969, 1970, in the Marine Corps and I Corps. 6 years ago, I had the opportunity to return to visit Vietnam with a tour of 12 people. The people were very gracious. They'd sit down and talk with you. There was no animosity, and the country is just doing wonderful. It's almost on the cusp of democracy right now because of all the tourism. So the Vietnam I visited 6 years ago was not the Vietnam I fought in, and It's better for all of us, and I'm really happy that the country is doing well.
So let me ask you this, Harry, if you could hold on for a second. You know, I don't imagine you had a lot of fun in Vietnam in your first two tours there. Why was it that so many years later you made the decision to go back? Is that something you had to think about for a long time, or all of a sudden one day you just said, you know what, I got to pick up and go?
No, actually, I love the country. The people basically were very good, except for the people that are trying to kill you. But the country is beautiful. You've got mountains, you've got sandy beaches, you've got exotic animals and food, and, you know, it's just a wonderful, wonderful country. So as soon as they opened the gates and we could get the tour together, we went back over.
And, you know, a lot of vets, though, I imagine, would not look forward to the idea of going back. Is this something that you've talked about with fellow vets? Have you tried to convince them that, you know, maybe they ought to consider that?
Well, I don't try to convince them, and you're right, about 50% say no. No way, I'm not going over there again. But the other 50% say, yes, let me have the opportunity. And it's just a wonderful experience for the veterans out there that they should enjoy.
But it's got to be their decision.
Correct.
All right. Well, Harry, thanks so much for your time. So Nissa Rhee, there we go, Harry's story. He was there back in the 60s and part of the Marines, and then years and years later he goes back. Is it kind of a typical story that you've heard?
Yes, you know, there's a lot of people going back today, and, you know, especially in people go with the same kind of groups that they fought in. So I don't know if Harry went back with a group of Marines, but it's pretty typical for groups to go back with their fellow soldiers that they fought with, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Do you think that it makes them feel differently about the war? You know, a lot of them were very young when they were there, and they may not have been aware of the politics or any of that.
Yes, I think going back, it will definitely change their perspective about the war. You know, a lot of the people I've talked to who have gone back, you know, went back thinking that they had destroyed the country and that they had done, you know, some really regrettable things, especially since the conversation about the Vietnam War in the U.S. is such a negative one. But they go back and they find, as Harry said, you know, a beautiful country that's doing very well on the world stage. And, you know, they realize that, you know, it is possible to forgive themselves and to move on, just as the Vietnam and Vietnamese people have moved on.
800-642-1234, if you would like to join in, if you're a Vietnam vet or a vet of any war who has gone back to visit the place where you fought, give us a call and tell us what it was like for you. Why did you make that decision to go back where so many things happened? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Josh now. Josh is in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just tuned in, and it was interesting hearing Harry talk about going back to Vietnam. I'm a veteran of the Iraq War. I served two tours in 2006 and 2007, and I think, you know, I'm one of those who went over when they were very young and didn't have a good understanding of the politics that was involved before we went over there. And I think having gone to school since then and understanding more of the diplomatic policy that was involved and not being very happy with that, and since feeling pretty negatively about my service in Iraq, I think it's, you know, it's I guess a hope of mine that someday I'd be able to go back and, you know, and be there under different circumstances.
So what sorts of things, if you were to go back, I mean, as you make that trip over there, as you land, as you walk around the places you were, what sorts of things would you be looking for? What would you be thinking about?
Well, you know, the overwhelming experience for me the first time was just surviving. So, you know, you're constantly it's all threat based. You're looking at windows not to see who's on the other side, but whether there's a muzzle there, or you're looking for bombs on the side of the road. So, being able to go there and appreciate the culture that's there, the scenery, the people, and not having to be there and always filtering things through just intense suspicion and hostility. And I don't mean to seem dramatic, but I think any veteran who will talk to you about his time in a foreign country, your primary role there is combat. So it's really, it just puts a negative spin on wherever you go.
All right, Josh, thanks so much for the call. Nissa Ree, you know, Josh brings up a really good point. When you go back years later and sort of, I guess, more in the tourist mode, you really do have a different set of eyes for that country.
Yes, and he reminded me of something one veteran told me who's living there, Sewell Jones, also a Marine veteran. He said that, you know, during the war, he was in the DMZ, and he never saw a Vietnamese person that he wasn't shooting at. So one of his goals in going back was really to learn about the culture, learn about the food there, and see the country in a time of peace, and, you know, just as a tourist, as opposed to a soldier.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Lee is with us from St. Charles, Minnesota. Hi.
Hello. I was a Marine Corps rifleman, 68, 69, up by the DMZ, and I was fortunate to get involved with a group called the Dub Fund. It stands for the Development of Vietnam Endeavors, and we've been back twice. We've donated money and built schools and done water projects there, and it's been a very emotional experience. And at one school for the dedication, they had a big line of kids waiting for us, and we walked down the road leading to the school, and I said to my friend, well, we finally got our parade.
So yeah, did it change the way you felt about the war?
Well, I guess I was lucky I didn't have so many strong opinions. I think one thing is I've done a little research, and then so many people that served over there, there was such a wide range of experiences. One guy I went through boot camp with, he got to manage the bowling alley in Da Nang. So I think everybody had completely different experiences. And like a previous caller said, too, we were always out in the jungle. So I had very little interaction with Vietnamese civilians. So, but it was a very meaningful experience for me, and I'm very glad I've done it. And like another caller had said, too, you bring it up, and some guys, former veterans, think you're crazy for doing it, and others think they might be interested in going back.
Lee, thanks so much for the call. Nissa Ree, you know, as you look forward to the veterans, do you see more of this tourism taking place? Are we going to be hearing more about this and learning more about the war from veterans who have been back?
Yes, I hope so. You know, the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War is coming up, and the U.S. government is doing a lot of preparations for that anniversary. So I think there's going to be a renewed interest in the war in the coming years. And as more veterans go back to Vietnam, hopefully more people will find out about the great work they're doing in Vietnam, addressing some of these consequences of war and working alongside their former enemies.
And we should point out that, you know, there are some of these trips that are hard. In your piece, for example, you talk about some of the dioxin remnants of the Vietnam War. So some of these visits are not always pleasant.
That's right. There are still a lot of the remnants, the consequences of war that are still there. Agent Orange poisoning is one of them that's affecting now the great-grandchildren of the Vietnamese people who fought during the war. So it's something that's affecting generations after generations. And the unexploded bombs that are still in the land there are still killing children and people searching for medals there. So there are still some challenges from the war left that a lot of American veterans, such as this Dove Fund that the caller mentioned, are working on and trying to address some of these legacies.
Well, Nissa, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Nissa Ree is an author and journalist. Her piece, Why U.S. Veterans Are Returning to Vietnam, was the cover story in the Christian Science Monitor.
Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the latest unemployment numbers. They're down. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.